I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We speak of Mark Blythe at Brown University as the noisiest professor in the pub, the expert that everybody gets. His specialty is political economy, the mix of money and power. More often than not, he's confirming your intuition that the game is not played quite straight in any common interest. But 2020 is off the charts. This mix of pandemic disease, steep downturn in available dollars, and clamorous politics that doesn't ease the pain. Mark Blythe wonders if anybody can see just what is unfolding. He's got his own fresh questions on the table, like the wisdom of coming to America to find fame and fortune and happiness 20 years ago. He and I have been meeting off and on for a decade now in his virtual hometown Glasgow pub. And we are there again this week. No social distancing around. Strong talk about stuff we don't understand.
At this point, Chris, I don't think anybody knows anything. Let's try and get more specific. What can we actually say that's meaningful?
You tell me. I want a quick inventory of the damage beyond repair. Places I go, even in prosperous New England, feels like ghost cities, Mark.
Yep. And we got lucky because we have this thing called summer. So that enables things like restaurants and bars, etc., which turn out to be a surprisingly large part of the economy, to survive over this period of the pandemic. But there's definitely a reckoning coming for small businesses. One little statistic on this, and I'm not going to get the exact number right, but out of the X billion that was promised for small business support, a fraction, a mere, I think, 100 million or something, has been actually doled out to small businesses, mainly because the banks in charge don't make any money out of them and therefore make it very, very hard for them to get those loans. Meanwhile, the multiple billion dollar packages that were given out to airlines to prevent furloughs, they took the money, they used it, and now they're turning the furloughs into firings. So that's pretty much where we are.
Speak of the differences from the last time we talked at the end of March. The pandemic was new. You were celebrating the end of austerity. People were not going to be told to, you know, tighten their belts through this incredible crisis, and they were bailed out. You said they're bailing out the people for a change, and it was great news. At the same time, they were bailing out big corporations, hotels, as you noted. But today, the contrast I can't get over is the gigantic gains in the billions, hundreds of billions, in the billionaire class, and the fact that in the New York Times over the weekend, pictures of hunger, approaching starvation, food banks running out, food stamps running out at the lower end of this economy. We're in two different countries, and one of them is tiny, tiny in terms of numbers, vast in wealth. The other is the people.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair summary. I mean, one way to look at it, if you take the figures in that Times story, they said 1 in 7 is food insecure, which means hungry. So let's make it 1 in 8. That's 12.5% of the population. It's 45 million people. In addition, another 27 million people have lost their health insurance, which, oddly enough, is more or less the same number of people that was covered by Obamacare. So it turns out the virus did the Republicans' work for them. But going back to those 45 million people, let's then turn to the gains that the billionaire class have made. The latest numbers I saw from Bloomberg were something like $671 billion over a six-month period. Amazon stock has gone up 80%. In that period, as one example, Apple is over 11 months, I believe it is, basically went from a $1 trillion to a $2 trillion company. And what this means is, if you divide that $671 billion into 45 million people, if you just redistributed that, given every single one of those food insecure people $14,000, which would have not just ended food insecurity, would have pretty much ended the recession. So that's where we are. We know where our priorities lie, at least in this country. But it is different elsewhere, Chris. You can't just generalize from the US. The US is always the most extreme example. European countries have not thrown their populations under a bus. France is engaging in further targeted stimulus. This has given a great impetus towards green investment at the level of the EU. It's only the Anglo countries that are basically looking after the rich and throwing the poor under a bus. And even then, it's not true because the Irish aren't doing it and the Australians aren't doing it. It's really just the Americans. Really. The Brits are ending their furlough scheme, and there's a legitimate reason for doing this. Basically, in large service economies, about one third of the population change jobs every 12 to 18 months. So if you're 6 months into a pandemic and you know that certain sectors, for example, airlines are being crushed, then furloughing people on the expectation that those jobs are going to be there probably isn't as efficient as actually pretending you're not furloughing them and just paying them better unemployment benefits, which is the system that the Brits are actually moving to. The Americans, on the other hand, essentially said, we might give you a stimulus check, we'll give some money for furloughs that the Fed will give to the banks that you won't actually really get, and then we'll just break up for the summer and then you're on your own.
When did we stop bailing out the neediest?
Well, it didn't really start. I mean, as we said when we spoke last time, America took the strangest way possible to do this. You're using a 19th century technology, a check, to find people in the middle of a 21st century pandemic. What they could have done is they could have simply got everybody's social security number, signed up those social security numbers to a thing called Treasury Direct, which is a portal you can use at the Fed where you can buy bonds and Treasury paper, reverse that, and then use that to just transmit money straight out. You could have used PayPal, you could have used Venmo, you could have used all the things that people actually use. Instead, we decided to mail checks. Why? Because that basically enables us not to give out money.
Is austerity back then? You put a stake through its heart in March. Sounds like austerity.
No, it's not, because remember what austerity is. Austerity is the belief that if you cut the budget deficit down or reduce spending in a recession, you will inspire confidence amongst investors and the economy will grow faster because of the cuts. Nobody is saying this. Do not confuse austerity with simply not giving out truckloads of cash to people who aren't your constituents. That's just normal American politics.
You're describing where we are. How did we get here, Mark, looking back? In terms of an inadequate public health framework, but even old methods of mailing checks. Short question, I mean, what's wrong with us?
Well, there's nothing wrong with us. It's by design. Essentially, you have a Republican Congress that doesn't really want to engage in any of this at all, but understands on some level that unless they basically bail out the incredibly leveraged corporate sector, which employs lots of people, then the whole thing goes crashing down. So they bail out their constituents first, the ones that were using all the profits for buybacks rather than investment. You guarantee the labour markets to a certain extent through certain guaranteed furlough schemes with very large employers. And then you basically leave everyone else out on a drip and hope that it goes away. What we learned was that we thought this whole thing would be abated within 3 months, that there was perhaps 6 months of trouble. But in fact, it turns out there's going to be 18 months of this stuff at the very least. Now, it will end. But the question is, how resilient is the system that you've built? If you're basically looking at a place like Denmark, I know everybody's favourite little social democracy, but they're back at school. If you look at Sweden, even though they had a very controversial strategy of not locking down the entire economy and has been terrible in terms of the death count on older Swedes, at this point in time, their deaths are in single digits. Their economies are opening up. Why? Because they basically built shock absorbers and kept them going. We decided to run the car off the road with no shock absorbers and hope for the best.
That's what I took away from our last gab. The United States chose a very flexible, stripped-down economy, which is good for growth when things are good, but in a crisis, it's a disaster. We have no fallback, no shock absorbers, as you say.
You got no airbags. Yeah. That's it. And it's still true. Nothing has changed in that regard.
Well, we're going to have to get to this. What have we learned from a political standpoint, from a policy standpoint, even from an emotional standpoint about this world we've constructed?
We've learned, we're like the Bourbons. We've learned nothing and we've forgotten nothing. Nothing has been learned. If we'd learned anything, we would basically be doing high levels of contact tracing and testing. If we'd learned anything, we wouldn't be politicizing masks. If we'd learned anything, we wouldn't be pretending that this thing isn't really as damaging as it is. And we just refuse to learn those lessons. And then we turn them into partisan politics, whereby this is basically the one thing that the Democrats have got to beat Trump over the head with. And at the same time, 40% of the population still think he's great and will crawl over broken glass to vote for him. So we haven't learned anything.
Yeah, what do you hear from the Bourbons lately? I mean, one assumes that the United States is proof, is immune to this kind of folly. But part of what we're learning is that we're just another old empire and we could be headed for the boneyard. I still can't believe it, but we act that
way. Well, essentially, the United States has a huge structural advantage which just rests on one thing, and it's not even military power. It's the dollar. The dollar is 60% of global reserves, 70% of global transactions. Every other country in the world needs to earn dollars to do imports. We just get to print the thing. And the world economy, particularly now as it is constituted by exporting countries, and those countries earn dollars, which they then have to turn into an asset. Mm. So they buy treasury bills, which allows the whole thing to just continue on and on. But if you basically abuse the system to the point that we have, whereby we will do all sorts of insane domestic politics, we'll throw 45 million people into food insecurity while showering tax benefits on billionaires, eventually people will start to look for alternatives to that dollar. And they will find it. If the Europeans ever got their act together and basically issued what's called joint and several common debt, then they would be able to do that. If China was the China of 10 years ago rather than the scary China of today, and it was actually able to open up its capital account and allow inward investment and allow money to flow out, they could internationalize their currency and people would buy it. But it's literally only the sort of the scariness of modern China and the timidity of the Europeans that's keeping the Americans in their place.
We've got to come back to all of these points, but take the American political scene. The net result of the Democratic primaries and Trump's incumbency, of course, was that we're still in a very retrospective mode. Trump's trying to take us back to some great America, but the Democrats have delivered us back to a not enormously distinguished senator from the 70s who voted for a lot of the wrong things in that period. Where is the forward scope? Who's looking forward, Mark?
Well, I think a lot of this just comes down to a generational change. I mean, I don't know about you, Chris, but as I get older, you begin to understand that you get trapped into a certain way of thinking over a certain period of time. Things have worked for a long time. You're very reluctant to change them. And the American political system is built upon the idea of division of powers, which becomes gridlock. The federal government is relatively weak in comparison to many other countries. And the whole thing is designed not to move rapidly. That was by design. It's a feature, not a bug. So if you add that all together with an election whereby you have a 74-year-old facing off against a 78-year-old, don't expect them to do radical change. Radical change happens, as I've said in many places before, when the boomers finally stop being a voting bloc. Until that point, it's not going to happen.
Coming up, is it written into our stars now, the weaponization of issue politics? This is Open Source. The pandemic brought revelation of many kinds about the way we Americans live, with private for-profit hospitals, for starters, but scant public health as the world knows it. Our population is tiered by race and class in life expectancy and chronic conditions. It was news when it arrived, and it made room for progress. With our economist and sage Mark Blythe, I'm wondering if we've stopped absorbing those lessons.
We're not learning anything. We managed to take the second uprising in the American Civil Rights Movement, which had overwhelming support at the time of George Floyd, and politicize this to the point now that amongst white Republicans, support for the protests are now in single digits. Right? So we do what we always do. We've weaponized this against each other, even though it should be something that made us stop and think and come together and say we need to do better. That moment was there for a couple of months, and then it was weaponized, and then it was turned into party politics, and now we see the result.
Come back to the fundamental question that puzzles me, total amateur. Who is going to pay these damages? Where will the money come from? For example, I notice beautiful streets in Boston have been repaved to a fare-thee-well. They look fantastic. And I notice it in other towns and cities, too. A lot of those public works go on. Who's paying for it and when?
Well, in terms of state and local budgets, it's amazing that they're doing anything because they're pretty much underwater. Tax revenues have collapsed and the Fed has a program that's actually designed to help state and local authorities, but it comes with what's called a penalty rate of interest. So they'll shovel basically zero interest loans into airlines that are never coming back. But if you're the city of, let's say, Urbana-Champaign, then you need to borrow at 4% at a time when interest rates are effectively negative. So we're basically building failure into the system once again. In terms of where the money comes from, if you go to Foreign Affairs last issue, you'll find this wonderful essay by Sebastian Mallaby, a man who could hardly be described as a socialist, talking about how we live in the era of magic money. That is to say that you've got structurally low interest rates and you've got, in some cases, deflation rather than inflation. These trends have been 20 years ongoing. Central banks are changing their mandates to accommodate for the fact that they can't generate inflation, let alone raise interest rates to get rid of inflation. The whole system is now working on a basis that we barely understand. But what it essentially means is, so long as you've got some degree of positive growth in your economy, it doesn't really matter about your debt stock, because if the rate of growth in the economy is greater than the rate of growth in the debt stock falls. And also, we live in a world of such inequality that people forget these debts that you're taking on are called rich people's assets. And they've got so much money, they need to do something with it. And rather than sit in cash, they'll buy T-bills. In the short term, even with a bond market, there's no funding constraint on this stuff. The fact that, you know, Urbana-Champaign and other municipalities are starved of cash and laying off healthcare workers in the middle of a pandemic is once again pure politics. There's no economic reason for it to happen. This is absolutely standard conventional economics with the bond market as it exists just now. You've got negative real rates. That means that investors who are desperate for a safe asset will buy from you in such a way that they're paying you to issue the debt. That's the world we live in.
You can sell the debt almost indefinitely, but is the magic still with us?
We don't know. We've never been in this world before.
So many other symptoms of the mystery. Commercial real estate, for example. Everybody noting that so much office work can be done better, happier, at home, in a small town. What's going to happen to those buildings? They're still going up in Boston.
The minute there's a semi-effective vaccine, all the employers are going to ask you to come back to work. You know why? Well, none of them own those buildings. They're all on 3 to 5 year leases. Either you allow everyone to sit at home and you pay rent on this giant building and it's just a complete drain, or you get everyone to come back in and then you've got some justification for having the building.
They'll ask you to come back to work, but won't they say you can do it at home?
Why should they? No, seriously, why should they? Just because you can do something doesn't mean it's in the interest of your employer to let you do something.
Why is it better for him to...
You've got this giant building in Copley Square that's costing you $10,000 a day to heat it. You got people sitting at home. Wouldn't it be nice to have your building filled with the people you're paying anyway? Isn't there something to be said for FaceTime? Isn't there something to be said for the water cooler?
Speak of the small business casualties here. I'm noticing the empty bar rooms. Two of the notable losses in Boston were some of the best bars in the city. The Fours, down by North Station, was a famous hangout of the Celtics and the Bruins and their fans, a very peaceful, happy place for 40 years. The Poorhouse in the Back Bay. They called it Great Attitude, Great Pricing, Great Portions. Both of those institutions closed forever after basically 40-year careers and successful. That's not just small business, it's social landmarks, it's social capital of a sort.
Anything that you could call soft-touch services, even with a half-effective vaccine, is going to be severely stressed. And over the long term, commercial real estate is definitely overbuilt. But I don't actually think this is a gloom and doom story. If you think about Pret-a-Manger, they're basically a British company expanded globally. They exist because of this crazy world where people drive along 95 and 93. They spend 40 minutes in a car park crawling into Boston. And then they finally get to work. And if they're lucky, they get to stand for 15 minutes in a line at Pret-a-Manger to get a sandwich that was made by somebody who's probably making it on minimum wage. Why is that a good world? In the short term, employers might actually want you to come back to work. But in the long term, there's going to be massive overcapacity in all sorts of commercial real estate. So why not do something sensible with it? Some of those buildings are in really attractive areas. Some of them are built really well to basically green LED standards. Why not turn them into public housing? We've been crying out for public housing. If you want to have restaurants, your little sushi restaurant with 15 tables in a basement the size of a postage stamp's never coming back. So why not take the fact that price per square foot's going to fall and open up big European grand cafes of the Vienna style with tons of fans and lots of light and windows? We're going to redeploy all this capital. None of it's been destroyed. What cripples us is a lack of imagination on what to do with it.
That's so interesting. I want to hear your notion of where imagination could pop up. I see it, for example, in a rent-a-car service that brings the car to your door. It's a new wrinkle. But there will be people in the restaurant game, too, food trucks or wherever. We'll bring it to you, etc. But good food will survive. it's always a thrill when I see, that's American risk-taking, fun, young people doing something interesting and good. Where do you see it?
I agree with you, but to take the example of the car rental thing, right, it depends on who owns the platform, right? I mean, again, it could just end up like Uber. Uber basically runs a taxi firm, but basically throws all the costs of maintaining the cars onto the drivers. And when the drivers finally figure out that spending $2,000 to $3,000 a year on out of the money they're earning, maintaining their cars is a zero-sum proposition, they quit. And then they get another driver in until they figure it out. So if basically this is going to be young people hustling for minimum wage, driving around the cars of rich people when they're not using them, that's not really that great either. It depends on what the nature of the platform is. If you decentralize this, if this is something that actually the people who are working on it own it, then it's great. We all need more asset ownership. We all need the upside of asset returns. But I worry that what we're going to see after this is just massive reconcentration of practically every sector in the economy. And it's going to be, once again, the private equity and the billionaire classes that end up owning the lot.
That is the big point. Concentration of not only of capital, but of chain restaurants where we used to have a few local bars. Is that inevitable? Was it made inevitable in the original bailouts last March?
It was inevitable before that. I mean, the United States has become just more and more concentrated. There's a wonderful book by a French economist who teaches at NYU called Thomas Philippon, called The Great Reversal, came out last year. And Thomas came to the US at the same time that I did. And he noticed something that I noticed back in the day. When I first came here in the 1990s, I had people in the UK asking me to bring them back computers, bring them back cell phones, bring them back jeans, because everything was so much more expensive there and so much cheaper here. Sometime around 2000, it just stopped. Nobody asked you to do that anymore because it went the other way, right? The cost of two cell phones, a landline, and fiber optic and TV in Paris is 80 euros. Here, that package will cost you nearly $300. Why? Because in any city in the United States, there's only two cell phone providers, maybe three. There's only two internet companies. You know who they are, Cox or alternatively Comcast or Verizon. And every set, think about airlines. There's basically four airlines plus JetBlue. You want to go to somewhere in Florida for Thanksgiving? You know what the price is now. You don't even need to look it up. It's $500 each way. End of story. Every airline. So this has been going on for 20 years. All that's happened now with the bailouts and with the collapse in working people's incomes and the huge rise in saving of upper Americans is that that trend is going to get much, much worse.
What's the price of a concentrated economy?
Less innovation, less better products, more expensive products. Basically, your investment eventually drops because there's no point in investing because what you really care about is barriers to entry, whether they are legal barriers to entry or patents. You basically sit on your assets and you sweat the returns of the assets, and everybody tries to become king of the castle in their particular sector.
We are overtaken by rent seekers, you economists say.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Go out and buy Brett Christopher's book, Rentier Capitalism, R-E-N-T-I-E-R, right? It's coming out with Penguin Random House in November, and it's about the British economy. So this guy's a professor in Sweden in economic geography. But before that, he used to be a management consultant, and he cut his teeth on reading corporate balance sheets. So he basically took the entire British economy sector by sector and went through all the top firms and said, exactly how do these guys make their money? And it's just rents. Everywhere you look, whether it's telecoms, whether it's shopping malls, whether it's internet, whether it's travel, there's basically three or four big firms that have huge barriers to entry that stop everybody else competing, and they just set the prices.
As you say, it sounds terribly stagnant and
yes,
good for the few people who own the assets.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of this. Brett's book actually has the best explanation I've seen of Brexit. Because if you think about it, every business in Britain is like, why are we doing this? This is crazy. We're leaving the largest free trade bloc in the world so that we can strike independent free trade deals with places like Latvia. This makes no sense. Well, it turns out the backers of Brexit tend to be, guess what? Rentier firms. Because although they don't gain from being in Europe or Brexit, they actually lose from being in Europe because they have to suffer competition laws. And guess what? If they actually had Brexit, they'd be even more protected from competition. So it makes perfect sense for them to support it.
Before we say they're cooked, is there a way back for small business, family enterprises of any sort?
Yeah, there is, but it will take time. And it also depends upon how much we want to just basically have a choice between IHOP and Arby's. You know, at the end of the day, if consumers like that, if they're not really crying for the neighborhood restaurants, then that's what you'll get.
People are swarming out of cities who can afford it to get to the Berkshires or Vermont. What's the long-term rebalancing of urban and city life and industry and wealth?
I have no idea. Is this going to be a trend that persists, or is it going to be reversed when we have employers basically saying, right, you got a vaccine, get back to work? That move to the Berkshires won't look that great if you're ordered to come back into Back Bay. As for, you know, the exodus of people, yeah, I mean, it's happening amongst, you know, a certain class of people who have got enough assets and wealth and mobile jobs and digitally relevant jobs that they can do this. In terms of the 330 million people that constitute this country, it's a tiny sliver. Let's not exaggerate it.
Big picture question, Mark. In looking for mistakes or roads not taken, was there something wrong with the messaging about coronavirus right from the beginning? There was such a panic, such a disaster coming, that people went either of two different ways. Some said, I'm scared to death. Others said, hell with it. It can't be that bad. It's not going to scare me. And you got this pattern of defiance and disbelief on the right wing. And then on the left, sort of knowing conformity, masks everywhere, prudence, and a certain scorn for the idiots who didn't understand how bad this would be. But we've never gotten together on it politically. It came to match Trump and anti-Trump. Could it have been presented differently?
I'm not sure if it could have been presented differently, because you're dealing with something that is based upon models, which is based upon estimates, which is based upon fragmented data. You don't know what this virus is. You don't know what it's going to do. At first, we thought it was a respiratory virus, and now we tend to think it's a kind of cardiovascular disease. We're learning all the time as we go. Go back to Sweden. They did this very interesting, we're not going to lock down thing, but that was also seriously misreported. Swedes have very, very high public trust in their government. So what the government said was, we want you guys to basically self-quarantine. We want you to work from home. We're not going to shut down any businesses. If you need to come out, come out. Be careful, right? You know, we're not going to do like giant sporting events or concerts, and we'll see how it goes. And what they did was, they had a much higher case fatality rate for a while, particularly amongst the old. But then as this began to evolve, we figured out that essentially it's people over the age of 70 that carry the real brunt of this disease in terms of deaths, although younger people get these very complex symptoms that we're becoming aware of now. In short, we just didn't know. So, you know, could you play it different? Well, how can you play different what you don't know? Right. But, you know, in terms of the politics of it, though, sadly, it's written into the stars. Just everything in the United States at this point. I've been here for 30 years and I've never seen it this bad. Everything is weaponized for extreme politicization. There's hardly anything that isn't. I mean, I'm pretty sure at some point maple syrup will become a cultural conflict. Right. I don't know why, but, you know, at some point you could see this happening. I mean, anything can become basically you're either on the MAGA team or you're on the blue team.
If Donald Trump puts maple syrup on his pancakes, I mean, forget about it for
Blue America. You totally got it. That's exactly right. There's a wonderful piece by David Frum. There's a sentence I never thought I'd say. In The Atlantic, where he talks about Trump as, and I think this is quite brilliant, he's a secessionist from the top. Essentially, he is the president of Red America. He makes no attempt to say that he speaks for all Americans. You see this in his relationship to any of the race protests, right? He makes no attempt to pretend he even cares about this community. He then bombasts
John Lewis, who's he?
Yeah. No, he then bombasts us with, you know, I've been the best president ever for the minorities or whatever. But, like, take away the nonsense, right? His actions
best
speak louder than
Lincoln.
Words.
Since Lincoln.
His actions speak louder than words. So, you know, what is he doing? He's essentially appealing as much as possible to this one part of America. And he basically signals that he's, in a sense, in a war against blue America on behalf of red America. And, you know, when you get to that type of politics, it's really hard to dial it back.
Mark, I've been dying to ask you this question. Play your hero, John Maynard Keynes. Partly because he gave it such a wonderful title of his most famous book, The Economic Consequences of the War, that made his future in a certain way. Asking you to say, what are the economic consequences, large and small, that we have to know about of the pandemic? Think big.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of them. I mean, essentially, you're going to have even greater concentration in the economy. We have a dysfunctional political system that has become hyper-polarized to the point that they just walked off for summer rather than actually care about the 40 million Americans who are now food insecure. None of this is good, right? None of this is good. So, you know, do we need a crystal ball to take us out? Yeah, over the long term, you're going to see change. I think it's generational. Essentially, this is sort of the last great boomer election. Whether Trump wins or whether Biden wins, it's that generation that's still in charge. They don't want to pay taxes. This is why the Democrats are still obsessed with this nonsense called PAYGO in the middle of a magic money situation, which makes no sense whatsoever, except as signaling to old people, don't worry, we won't spend your money. And there's no movement on climate change. If Trump wins, it's a disaster. America actually leaves the Paris Accords, and we've been systematically undermining every environmental regulation in the book for the past 3 years. You can expect that to accelerate. If Biden comes in, you kind of like put a foot into the wall as the water's coming over, but you're not going to do anything that different. He's talking a good game on $2 trillion in investment and green stuff. If that happens, I'll be deeply impressed. If it never happens because it never gets through Congress, I will not be surprised. We have the system that was set up for 18th century politics, whereby an electoral college made sense because you were worried about someone trying to make themselves into a king, whereby this separation of powers was designed to make sure that the state is weak so that individual states themselves govern themselves. And we're facing global pandemics, we're facing global warming, we're facing global security challenges. And it's just a governmental system which is basically designed to fail.
Coming up, what Mark Blythe means by the last great boomer election day on November 3rd. This is Open Source. And what of the international stakes in trade, reputation, growth, and health? Mark Blythe's line is that a deep rethink of globalization will continue, not toward anything like neat national sufficiency, but through a maze of fragmentation and disorder.
Well, it's not as if we're doing any favors again on this one. Essentially, the obsession with China, which I kind of understand because basically they do want to steal every bit of tech that they can and are very good at it, that's basically pushing us towards self-sufficiency. So, for example, China produces, I think it was something like 89% of American PPE for hospitals. That's something that should change. Is it actually changing? I remember talking to someone who actually builds factories, and they said, you know, if you want to build a factory that makes Q-tips, the licensing alone is going to take you 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So before you even build it, right, all the legal permits, the safety, everything like that, it's not as if you can just turn this stuff off overnight. Meanwhile, in terms of the security threats, once again, you know, Russia poisoned someone and we refuse to even comment on it because it becomes so, how can I put it, so much in Putin's camp for reasons I cannot understand, that that's becoming an issue. The Europeans basically are coming together, I think, in an interesting way because they realise now that they're stuck between the proverbial rock and the hard place. Even if Biden wins, the notion that sort of we go back to the 1990s transatlantic consensus is over. Plus you have China basically saying, we will either buy your assets if you sell them to us, or we'll come in and nick them, hence all the fears over Huawei and Chinese tech. So you're seeing this splintering across the world, whereby France and Britain say, we're not going to have Huawei in our 5G, even though they don't have substitutes. Ericsson is the closest thing the Europeans have got. The Europeans have no digital platforms or digital champions at scale anywhere in the world. Everybody there uses Zoom. Everybody uses Google. They recognize that puts them at a tremendous disadvantage. But it's not clear exactly what they do about it. So this is not a sort of an orderly retreat to national sufficiency. This is a disordered fragmentation. And, you know, that can play out in various ways.
People want to call it a downward spiral, but is it?
No, not necessarily. I mean, look, you know, if you're a small, well-run, open economy, you tend to have done rather well in coronavirus. I mean, I'm sure you've seen this little GIF or meme that runs around on Twitter and places whereby it's like, what countries have done badly? Well, let's think about it. It's all the ones that are run by alpha male populist leaders, Brazil, the United States, the UK, etc., etc. Which ones have done well? Small open economies, under 16 million people, all run by women, right? If you're one of those countries, if you have high public trust, if you make stuff that people actually want, you'll still be fine. I mean, ultimately, these societies survive because they're too small to tear each other's faces off. The problem comes with big countries, whereby there's no fellow feeling. There's no affectation. There's no possibility of compromise. There's a red America and a blue America. And if one wins, the other one necessarily loses. It's very, very hard to sustain that over the long term.
Mark, among the great splits of this period is the now absolutely unmistakable unmasking of Wall Street as a rich man's game, and then the totally separate world of suffering from newly unemployed, chronically poor, chronically ill people at the bottom. Will stock prices ever again be taken as a general measure of anything except for the rich? And what will we substitute as a measure of overall health, progress, rise and fall of our own economy, the whole thing?
Well, it's not clear to me that the Dow Jones was ever an indicator of anything apart from how well rich people are doing, because rich people own all the equities.
Right.
If you go onto my Twitter feed, you'll see yesterday I posted a little infographic I nicked off the Financial Times, which basically shows that the share of equity by the bottom 50% of the United States is in the low single digits, and that the top 1% effectively own half of it. So, you know, what does that show? It's basically, it's a rich people's happiness index. So that's just what it is. And the thing is, you don't even use it to raise capital. I mean, it's the great sort of, you know, lie about the stock market, that companies come there and issue shares and that gives them the money to invest. Absolute nonsense. You don't use this stuff for investment. Investment comes from retained earnings or debt issuance. You don't use it on the stock market. These are literally little playing tokens for people who can afford to buy extremely expensive assets. Nothing more, nothing less. In terms of indicators, well, you know, for an indicator to work, it has to apply to everyone. And food insecurity doesn't apply to the Hamptons. Food insecurity doesn't apply to Beacon Hill. So, you know, we live in a world in which, you know, you're going to need very, very different indicators because people are living incredibly different lives.
We need something that forces everybody to see the big picture, maybe especially the people at the top, to notice the hungry ones.
Usually that's when the hungry ones mobilize themselves in such a way as to actually draw attention to themselves as a mass group, as a collective actor.
It's about time.
Right, but it's been about time forever. Yeah, interesting thing today, there's even a sort of a push among some conservatives to recognise unions as being a good thing, because ultimately unions are what protects the real wage share of the working classes. And they're like, yeah, there might be something in this, because it turns out that basically billionaires making off with all of the gains might not be sustainable over the long term. Well, that one wins the No Shit Sherlock Award for the week. But the question is, well, what are you actually going to do about it? Right. Are you going to tax Bezos's capital gains at 80%? No, you're not. You're still going to allow him to take capital gains at 15% if he runs an internal hedge fund. Right? I mean, it's gig after gig after gig. So, you know, until basically there is an actual mobilization. And again, I go back to generational. I think this happens generationally. So long as the boomers are the largest voting bloc, nothing changes. It's generational. Once the millennials become the largest voting bloc, along with some rogue Gen Xers like me, then you will actually see real demands for change. But until this point in time, we will basically continue to distribute upwards and tell everyone else that it's going fine, because it is for them.
The Bezos case is almost laughable in the sense that he just gets richer and richer and richer with a talk about monopoly, talk about crowding out small business, talk about high prices and the high end of the economy being served above all. How long can he keep this up? How long will he be allowed?
There's an error in what you said there. Amazon does not give you high prices. Amazon takes everybody else's margins, which used to be called the high street or the shopping mall or the mom and pop's place that sold it, and they destroy them. And the way they destroy them is by lowering prices. One of the reasons we don't have inflation, we have basically deflation, is because the pricing power of these organizations is such that they can crush everyone else's profit margins. And what that means is that you get that as consumer surplus. I mean, you know, you got to think about it. I can go on Amazon now and I can buy a podcasting mic imported from wherever in the world for $200. That type of mic used to cost just a few years ago $500.
Right.
You used to be able to, you want a flat screen TV that'll cover your whole wall, you can get it now for $1,000 with Roku built into it. Right? I mean, these things have just been falling in price. What's going up in price is food. Nobody buys their food from Amazon unless you're going to go to Whole Foods, and then you know that you're paying a premium because that's the rich people's shop. So there's a way in which Amazon's playing a fantastic game here. They destroy everyone else's capital and redistribute it as cheaper prices to everyone, plus the convenience of searching and shopping online and delivery. And in doing so, they basically insulate themselves from criticism because the vast majority of people who use it think it's good.
Put on your Lloyd Keynes hat once more, Mark, and give us all a general look forward into the post-pandemic. Advice for young people coming out of school looking for what kinds of work, but also a view of the globe. You like to say that the populists are still out there in terms of political balance, sanity, cohesion in our world. I mean, big picture going forward.
Big picture outlook for the United States is very, very bleak, sadly.
Really?
Ultimately, if the Democrats win, then red America, 40% of people who are definitely in Trump's camp, will feel effectively disenfranchised. If the result is close, we can probably expect it to be contested by the incumbent. And you can imagine a situation where a couple of Republican states refuse to send their electors to the Electoral College. The whole thing goes to the Supreme Court and we have a rerun of 2000. None of which is great for stability, cohesion, coming together, or any of those things.
You talk to college kids every day. Where should they be looking for not just work, but a life, a future?
A small country run by a woman.
Interesting.
Go to Ireland. No, seriously, go to a place like Ireland. Go to Scotland, right? I mean, it's just, people have just chilled. You don't have any of this stuff. I'm honestly growing so tired of the United States personally. I can't wake up in the morning and just feel depressed all the time because everyone's angry with each other all the time. Hmm. It's exhausting. This used to be a place of hope, a possibility. Really, where anyone could come and try and do it and make it and do it. And now this is just a total fantasy. It's not even a fantasy, it's a nightmare because it just simply isn't true anymore. I mean, even, you know, to go to college, if you look at the returns on it, unless you go to one of the very, very top schools, it costs an absolute fortune to do so. Right. And what's happening in labour markets is unless you're in the top 10%, your wages are pancaked. So how is that a good investment? All of this needs to be addressed, but I just don't see a 74-year-old and a 78-year-old who have polarised the country ever doing it.
Yeah, and no matter which way it comes out, there's going to be incredible anger. There may even be riots. There may even be a contest over the results. And yet, the other thing you know is that this kind of screwed up anger can't last forever, right?
Oh, it can. Why do you think I wrote a book called Angrynomics? This has been 30 years in the making.
Explain that.
This anger is there and it is burning. When you basically take a large chunk of your society and disconnect them from the elites who run them, turn them into social problems to be nudged and to be managed, ignore them except at election time, patronise them or ignore them, and then demand that they're loyal to you while all the gains go to a handful of cities and an even smaller number of people, why on earth would you expect people not to be angry? Then you mishandle a pandemic. Before that, you mishandle a financial crisis. It's always little people bearing the costs. That anger is there. It's just a question of who gets to interpret it and who gets to weaponize it. And that's why Trump has been so popular. Yes, it's true he's the Republican. Yes, it's true that on average, his average supporter is richer than the opposition. Well, he's a Republican, so you would expect that. But all of this is going to be sorted out in battleground states, largely amongst people who are not in the elite, singularly not in the elite. And what is really interesting is how the Democrats basically cannot speak to that community in the way that he can. And that's because they are furious.
We missed a big opportunity to join the issue with a much edgier Democratic candidate. Maybe Elizabeth Warren, maybe Bernie, maybe Andrew Yang. The worst of this election is that it doesn't really take on what we're worried about. That's my view.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't. I think you're absolutely right. It doesn't name the thing. Right. Essentially, the Democrats are down to two things. They are down to defeating Trump because Trump is odious.
Right.
Hard to contest that one. And then they definitely want to do something that's different. What that is, we're not entirely sure. Right? What the Republicans want to do is to not even have a platform and just basically go with the cult of Trump. Because it'll be all right if you do, or your wagon's hitched to it, so you got no alternative. It's not exactly progressive, is it?
No, it's very plausible. While we're up, you better call the election for us. You get big dividends if you get it right. What's going to happen?
I still think that Trump is in within a shout despite the polls. It's not as clear as last time, but I would simply extrapolate from the last time. If what brought him there were a bunch of people who I just described as being basically the furious, the ignored, and the people who find themselves on the skids as everyone else, or rather a very small number of people, are making off with the cash, then so long as he can mobilise them, they are very, very, very effective in terms of getting out the vote. What exactly is Biden mobilising? You've got people signalling pay-go conservatism on the fiscal side. At the same time, you're telling your young people you really care about the Green New Deal, but you won't call it a Green New Deal. They're saying that Black Lives Matter, but they're not really believed by the activists themselves. Mm. Are they all going to show up? How many Biden T-shirts have you seen? How many Biden bumper stickers have you seen? It's not exactly a landslide, even with the polls going that way. So my hunch on this one is it going to be contested and it's going to go to the Supreme Court? And if it does, you're going to get a party line vote, just as you did in 2000.
Mm. What about the double reverse scheme that people were talking up the last few days, that Trump could win big in the hard ballots that are counted on November 3rd, but then that Joe Biden could well reverse it as the mail ballots get counted over the next couple of weeks?
Sorry, we'll have shut down the post office before then. What are you talking about?
Do you think
that honestly on election night he's going to declare victory and then 10 days later go, oh, you're right, I didn't really get all those votes? Do you honestly think that's going to happen?
Honestly, I think almost anything could happen. I think we could have riots.
Quite possibly. And if that's the case, then, you know, we all need to consider exactly where our country is headed and what we're going to do about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I came here voluntarily. I was an immigrant who became a citizen. And, you know, eventually you have to reconsider your choices. There's a piece in a physics journal, I think it's called Archive X Physics, online. It's a guy from MIT. And he basically modeled what happens when equilibria become destabilized. And if you look at it from a kind of physics point of view, these equilibria that we take for granted, you know, the post-war consensus, the great Fordist era of the working class, when basically the institutions complemented each other and you got a rising tide that lifted all boats, they're incredibly hard to put together and even harder to manage over the long term. They're quite sensitive to shocks. And we've been shocking our model for the past 40 years. And the conclusion of the paper is that once you shock these things and these things fall apart to a certain extent, you literally can't put them back together again. They have to recalibrate on an entirely different basis. I think that's where we are, or we could be.
You left a tantalizing hint there for young people coming out of school. Look around the world for small countries run by women and go there and do something interesting. Let's hear a few suggestions.
Well, I mean, that was kind of a jokey thing because, of course, it's actually quite hard to immigrate to places, even if you have an American passport, which used to be the golden ticket. So, unfortunately, that's really be the option for people. It's really not going to be the option for people. I mean, if you have an Irish grandparent, you might get away with it, but that's not most of us. So, essentially, you know, you have to stand and fight for the society that is yours. And essentially what we have here is a generational conflict. You have the people that benefited from the post-war growth story where they didn't really pay for anything and most of it was free. They then got the asset growth of the 1980s and 1990s. As they headed into retirement, they all got it bailed out in 2008 and again in 2020. And now basically this generation who has indebted their young people with huge amounts of debts with no corresponding assets while they hold all the assets, that's what fundamentally has to change. And until that changes, it's going to be very difficult to imagine a more positive future. You're coming out of school in the United States now, and you're probably coming out with somewhere in the region between 40, and depending on your program, and then $40,000 to $140,000 in debt with no corresponding asset, unless the degree you have is from a really top school that is highly specialized and highly sought after. It's quite common for people to come out of law school with $200,000 in debt. Paying that back is basically thousands of dollars a month for 20 years of their lives. So what do? You delay purchases, you delay families, you delay home purchases, you can't save for a deposit. We're absolutely stuffing our young people so that we can basically continue to shovel cash to the old and the rich. That's what young people need to realise and focus on.
Mark, you're priceless. We're going to try all your remedies, and we want you to stop back in the pub anytime. Thank you, Mark Blythe at Brown University. You're the best.
Pleasure.
Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about storytelling in a time of social distance. Find all the conversations at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Matt Lizette engineered it. Mary McGrath is our executive producer in isolation. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.